thought you asked.
Welcome to We Thought You Asked, a podcast where we chat about life, our pop culture vices, and give lots of unsolicited advice and opinions for free. I'm Tori.
And I'm Kelly. And let's hop into the show.
Hey, everyone.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to the podcast this week.
Tor, how was your week?
Oh, my gosh. So fun. So I got to go to the live recording of the Watch What Crappens podcast when they came into town in San Diego last week, and I had the time of my life.
I saw that you reposted a photo from the show that they put on their own Instagram account.
Yeah.
So you're basically famous.
Basically. In our cosplay, our cousin Michelle is like one of my best friends, and she came into town from Salt Lake City with some of her good girlfriends who are so sweet, and we had the time of our lives. But this is the second show that Michelle and I have gone to, and we dressed up for the last one, we dressed up for this one, so it was really just so exciting. It's like being a kid but like an adult. It was just so much fun. And the next day I had like an emotional hangover, I think, like I wasn't even drinking the night before, but I was just like so energized, and it was the first time I'd been around a big crowd, and just, yeah, the next day I was like, oh man, okay, this I guess is your mid-30s when you go out and have a ball. So, but it was fun.
Nice. That sounds great. I have no idea what your shirts meant. I've never listened to the podcast, but I know it's one of your faves. You're a diehard Watch What Crappens fan. So
I am
very happy that you're living your best life out there.
I really am living my best life now. So it was great. And I cannot recommend them more highly. If you guys watch any Bravo shows at all, they're just so funny. And if they come to a town near you, it was truly the best time ever. It was so fun.
Especially now that we've talked about, we are scaling back a little bit on the Bravo-centric conversations. I don't watch Bravo, and I know you're scaling back a little bit. So
yeah,
we'll refer you to Watch What Crappens.
Well, the best thing about them is even since I've been really like cutting back on the shows on Bravo that I follow, because I am having that entire internal battle of like, this network is so problematic, yada, yada. But I will still listen to their recaps, even of the shows that I'm not currently watching, because I have watched them in the past. So I basically know the characters and what's happening, and they are just so funny. It's like, they're hilarious. So I could not recommend them more highly.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, my week was a lot more chill than yours. Just kind of enjoying San Diego. I mean, I wasn't supposed to be in San Diego this past week.
That's right.
If you haven't been listening to the past few episodes, I was supposed to be back in Bali right now, but found out that I need to have knee surgery. So I'll be here for the next several weeks while I'm just waiting it out. So had a few chill days, some walks on the beach, exploring our old neighborhood. It's been really fun and very chill.
That's nice.
Today is our last day together because I'm driving Max to LA tomorrow to go fly back out to Bali. We have a dog that he's got to take care of. We have a company that he's got to take care of. So we are separating for at least the next 3 to 4 weeks or so. It's interesting because we actually don't know when we'll next see each other. So,
which that is very interesting because you and Max have not spent any time apart really in probably years, right?
I think the longest we've been apart in a few years is maybe 2 nights.
Yeah. So that's pretty wild. I mean, you guys are both very independent people, but just situationally, like it just hasn't worked out that you guys have spent any time apart in the recent past. So I'm sure it'll be a little bit hard to be away from each other for that long.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting saying goodbye to someone when you're not sure when you'll see them next. But fortunately, yeah, with technology today, we'll get FaceTime to see each other on FaceTime.
Yeah.
We can Zoom. We can do all the things. So yeah. I'm not stressed about it. But yeah, it's not an ideal situation, but we'll get through it. It'll be fine. And I just get to live my best single life at 32 for the next month.
I don't think that's really how it works. I don't think you get to go live your single life, but I mean, to each their own.
I mean, except for dating and all of that. But, you know,
Speaking of relationships, I completely meant to talk about this last week, but we got so sucked into the Love is Blind season 2 recap that I completely forgot about it. Have you watched?
Which we'll touch on at the end of this episode, by the way.
Oh yeah, don't worry. We have a lot of opinions that we have not discussed yet. So it'll be interesting to hear what Kelly's and mine are and how different or similar. But did you watch The Tindler Swindler on Netflix?
Yes. I have watched that in the past week, and I watched Inventing Anna, so good, so interesting.
So Inventing Anna, I haven't watched. I was really excited to watch it when I first heard it was coming out, but I thought it was going to be more like Tindler Swindler, like documentary kind of style. And then I heard that it was more actors, and I don't know, I heard kind of negative feedback on it, so I opted out. But you liked it?
I did. I wish the episodes weren't as long as they were.
Okay. Are they hour like long episodes or what?
I think so. Okay. Somewhere close to an hour, but still really good. I did deep dives when all of it came out because I was so fascinated by it. I read all of the news stories that I could get my hands on. And overall, the documentary really shows the reality of what happened based on what I read from these news articles. I mean, of course, it's dramatized and a little more over the top because it's a Netflix drama, but
right.
I thought it was really interesting. But overall, between these two shows, I thought that it was so interesting from a psychological lens, the kind of people who can do these things. If you don't follow either one of these stories or you haven't watched them, they're both on Netflix. The Tindler Swindler is about this guy named Simon Leviev, and he used the dating app Tinder to pose as this billionaire son of an Israeli diamond tycoon.
Well, I'd like to remind everyone too, Tinder is the app that I did meet my husband on, so they're not all losers out there.
Well, we'll touch on that in a second, because that is a funny point from the documentary. But anyways, so he's posing as this guy that's not his real name. I mean, it is because he got his name legally changed, yes. But he's this Israeli man who started love bombing these women that he would meet on the app. He would take them on private jets and take them in fancy cars, bring them to fancy restaurants. And within a month or two, he would start asking them for large sums of money, basically saying that his life was in danger because of his family's business and he couldn't use his credit cards because they were being tracked by his enemies. So he would convince his girlfriends to take out loans, take out credit cards, and allow him to just rack up these immense heavy charges, which he would then turn and use on the next woman to complete the con one more time.
It was fascinating.
So that was interesting. Yeah. And then in Inventing Anna, this is about this young to mid 20-year-old Anna Delvey, also not her real name. And she was posing as this German heiress who conned people into buying into her business, buying into her story, buying her things. She wanted to create the social club in New York. So she convinced banks to give her credit lines. She was in the process of getting $30, $40, $50, $60 million loan. She convinced friends to give her private jets. I mean, she was just so ruthless in what she got from these people. And as I watched both of them, I was kind of thinking, the only way that you can be like this is if you're a sociopath, right? Like, you can't have empathy towards people and commit these crimes. So I'm so interested to hear what your thoughts are on this as a therapist, as someone who has studied these types of people. Let me know.
Well, I will preface it by saying I haven't actually studied these people, but I am a therapist and I do have a good idea about, you know, the psychological makeup of people and things like that. I think there probably is a good argument that people with behaviors similar to those of these two people that you just described really are consistent with what we see in sociopaths. You know, if there is a complete lack of empathy, there is a disregard for the law and rule and order, and there is a really like a chameleon effect of them being who they think you want them to be in the moment to get from you what they want to get from you. And I think that those traits are all extremely consistent in both the Tindler Swindler and in Anna Delvey. And it just is really fascinating how far both of them were able to get. You know, it blew my mind watching the Tindler Swindler, just the fact that these seemingly very normal, not affluent women were able to get these incredibly high amounts of money, these loans that were personal loans in their names, just by cheating the system, like falsifying like a pay stub or something. Like the Tindler
Swindler. Yeah, just to give you a little bit more color, the biggest victim who's kind of the leading star of Tindler Swindler, she gave him more than $270,000, which she got fully from credit cards and I think 8 different loans on top of that.
Yeah, like it sounded like some of those were like payday loan type of loans too, just like really high interest, you know, just wild. But it fascinated me because I've never really considered that it would even be possible to make that happen. You know, does that even make sense? Like, it's just fascinating how well he knew the system to know exactly what documents needed to be falsified, exactly how to sell this story so that these like middle income appearing women were able to take out these large sums of money. With Anna Delvey, it's a little less shocking to me because she was rolling with these really affluent crowds and these people did have access to money and funding. But the Tindler Swindler, that was wild to me that he was able to get the amount of money from these people that he did.
I guess it's not shocking to me as someone who worked in loans and banking for most of their career. I've seen these loan documents. They're not that difficult to falsify if you wanted to.
That's wild.
So I'm not shocked from that perspective at all. Yeah. I mean, what does banking paperwork look like? Every bank is different.
Right.
Even when you print it from different parts on your bank, it can look different. And so there's not like a common way that this should look if you know what should be on it, which you can find out with probably a pretty easy Google search. It's not that hard to falsify these things. Anna Delvey, she just posed as her family's banker by using a voice-changing app and would talk to the lawyers and the bankers themselves. Yeah. So it's not shocking from that point, but what's shocking to me is just the type of person that can be so ruthless and careless for other people's feelings, for other people's livelihoods, knowing that they're putting everything that they have on the line for you. And then you just go spend it on nice clothes and nice dinners, like both Anna Delvey and Simon Leviev did.
Yeah. You know, I come from the mindset, and I think there's a lot of research to back this up, that, you know, people who lack empathy aren't born that way. You know, there sure probably is some sort of biological component that impacts our personality, just like all of us have some biological impact that, or biological factors that impact our personality. But a lot of it is shaped by the environment that you were raised in. And that doesn't necessarily mean your family that you grew up in. It could be, you know, the community that you grew up in. But regardless, you know, I think that there's probably some intense trauma that both of these people experienced if we really went back and looked at their upbringing from the time they were born until the time they were 18, I would say.
This is a good, interesting point that you're bringing up because Inventing Anna, they do dive into that.
Oh, interesting.
They talk about
how
she was a teenager, she moved to Germany from Russia where she was born. Okay. To be with her father.
Yeah.
And the journalist actually goes and visits her family in Germany in the show to really dive in and see, is there any truth to the things that she's saying? The journalist is just kind of so convinced by her lies that she really wants to dive in and make sure that there's not some secret wealth or he's not an oligarch or anything like that. And so she goes to Germany and meets the family, and the family says basically that they never felt like Anna was a part of their family. They have another child that very much felt like theirs, and Anna from a very young age just felt different. And I think that's what that sociopathic behavior looked like to her family, to her parents.
Okay, so this is kind of where it gets complicated, right? People really have a hard time self-reflecting. This is all of us. Like, this is myself included. It's really hard to look at yourself and say, how did my actions negatively impact people that I was responsible for, people that I care about, people that, you know, are supposed to be important people in my life. It's very, very hard for all of us to do that. And what often happens if, you know, someone has gotten in trouble for doing something and you go back to the family, the parents especially, and you're trying to gather information to better understand their upbringing and their situation, people get defensive. They get really secretive. They try to pretend like their family is fine. It's this person who is the problem, but that's just not reality. I mean, unless someone can send me research that supports that out of an entirely healthy family unit, there is one person in that family unit one child who grew up in an extremely healthy family unit with three or four other healthy family members, and they themselves are really struggling and having sociopathic tendencies. I personally don't believe that. I've never seen it to be true. And I think it's just extremely consistent with the self-reports that we get from the family members of people who commit similar crimes, you know? And it makes sense. Like I said, people don't want to say, yeah, these are maybe signs. Maybe we could have gotten more support learning how to parent these situations. Like, there's just no way that you can convince me. Again, I don't believe that kids are born sociopaths. I think that you develop a lack of empathy as very bad things happen to you throughout your life. And I'm not saying that that excuses Anna Delvey's crimes that she committed against people as an adult or the Tindler Swindler. That's not the case at all. But I'm saying, I think it really is an important thing to discuss because we really have to understand that the impact that children's environments have on them does shape them. And as adults, we really have a responsibility to make sure that kids are in an emotionally safe environment, because when they're not, bad things happen. They learn really unhealthy ways to cope. They lose empathy for other people. But I don't believe that what her family told the reporter is true. And I think if you were to peel back the layers, that there would be a lot there that helped explain the trauma that she definitely experienced.
That's really interesting. And something that I definitely don't understand as someone who has not studied this kind of stuff. So it's fascinating to hear your take on it. So do you believe that all murderers, all sociopaths, or truly everyone, that is a result of trauma that they have been through?
Yeah, I think that there is a strong argument to be made that when people grow up to commit really horrific crimes and those crimes are a result of lack of empathy against other people, that if we peel back the layers and we go back in time, we will find trauma in their childhood. I just think that that is what we have come to learn in the mental health field. That is what research shows. That is a strong indicator. There is this false narrative and an idea that we used to believe as a society, and I think a lot of people still do, that there's like a potential for a bad seed, right? Like, someone, you could have the most loving, nurturing environment, but you could just be so unlucky and it could be like the omen and you birth a devil child. It's just not the reality, right? Like, it's just not. And so again, it's not to excuse people who commit crimes, because, you know, that is just enabling this. Have you heard the term intergenerational trauma before?
Yes, very much so. I've studied it a lot because of my dog.
I thought maybe you'd say because of our family or something, but okay, because of your dog.
No, but I do find it very fascinating that trauma, you can see it in dogs, has been passed along. And is it nature? Is it nurture? And I've really looked into where does his anxiety really come from? Because he was taken off the streets from such a young age. Could he actually have memory of this abuse? Or was it something different? Was it his mom teaching him to be fearful of these things because of trauma that she's been through?
Right.
Yeah. Or is it truly passed through DNA? And it's been studied with dogs. It's been studied with humans.
Right.
And I'm really fascinated by all of it. But I will let you explain it a little bit better than what I've done on my one-year-old puppy.
So the idea of intergenerational trauma is twofold. So there's a nature and a nurture aspect to this. And what it means is that when our parents experience a traumatic event in their life, trauma, we know, actually changes our brain chemistry. Like it actually changes the way that our brain works, especially until we receive therapy and things like this to really process the trauma. And so that is the biological component of trauma. Well, trauma also changes the way people think about things. It changes the way that they cope, that they perceive the world around them. Like you were saying, Kelly, like maybe your dog's mom experienced trauma and therefore she was distrusting. And I'm just throwing this out there. Obviously, I don't know in this situation, but maybe she was distrusting around men, you know, after that, because maybe a man physically mistreated her, or maybe a man physically mistreated her at some point. Well, if she's raising your dog and she models this behavior that men are distrustworthy, then your dog is going to pick up on that, right? And it's going to influence them. But also the biological components of that trauma can be passed down as well. And so until someone within a family unit breaks this cycle of intergenerational trauma by getting therapy and by understanding why they do the things they do and they view the world in the way that they do, and they have the anxieties and the fears that they do, and go so on and so on, until someone stops this cycle, it continues generation to generation to generation. And so I think, you know, intergenerational trauma is definitely an aspect that should be looked at when we're talking about con artists. I think, again, you know, there probably is a significant trauma history there. I think it's not unlikely when we're talking about criminals that there is a parent that had similar behaviors, not always, but oftentimes. And again, it doesn't have to necessarily be an immediate family member that traumatized this person as a child. Like it could have been someone at school or in their church, or, you know, someone else that had influence and exposure to them that impacted them in a traumatic way. And for whatever reason, they didn't receive help. They didn't receive therapy as a child. And so they learned these maladaptive coping skills. It's not healthy. It's not good for society or for other people, but essentially, at its core, if you look at it, it's a way to keep you safe from other people hurting.
There's a study that I read about when I was doing this research on my dog. And basically, researchers had a rat and they would zap the rat's foot while they pump cherry blossom scent into the air. So they started associating pain with the scent of cherry blossoms. And that rat had a baby rat and they had that rat raised by a different rat. And that rat would never smell cherry blossoms until they were ready to do the experiment, and they would pump it into the air, and that rat would be fearful of cherry blossom smells.
Yeah.
And even the next generation, the grandchild of the original rat, also would be fearful of this. So it really is something that is biologically proven, and I find it really fascinating because it's really hard to pinpoint where that comes from. And do you think that it can be something like you are raised in a really healthy family, but because of these generational things that maybe are passed through our DNA, that it can result in that? Or do you think it's kind of a compounding factor that the parents of this child did not get the help that they need at the time, and now it's compounding? Or what are your views on that?
Yeah, I think it's compounding. Again, I'm not saying that in every situation that it's the family unit that created, you know, or that was the direct result of someone turning into a sociopath. I think that's a very oversimplified way of looking at this. And I think as a society, we just want to place blame on people, right? Like, these things are scary things. To think that people are sociopathic out there, that's freaking terrifying. Like, it scares me. And I understand a lot of it. And it scares me. It should scare me. That's terrifying. But we want to make these really complicated, scary situations really simple and be able to say, well, it's your fault. If only this happened, this one thing, then things would be different. But that's just not the way that life works. And I think the value in understanding the way that people grow up to be adults who lack empathy and commit crimes against other people, the value in understanding how they get there is so that for future generations, we can actually do something to lessen the amount of people that are going to have that same life journey, you know? So it's not to like directly target, but to answer your question, I do think it's more of a compounding issue. I think that there is definitely a biological component. I don't think any of us can disregard that. That goes into all of our personalities. And I think that there also is some sort of environmental impact, you know, with the people around us when we're kids. And I think it's just factual. That's just how it works. So yeah, I think if we really peeled back these layers, again, there is probably some significant trauma that these people experienced in their childhood.
So we're talking about lack of empathy here. Right. But one thing I want to touch on is a lack of empathy amongst viewers of these crimes.
Oh, especially with Tindler Swindler.
For the victims.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
There's been a lot of blame on people who have given up their money to Anna Delvey, to Simon Lviv.
I know.
When they are true victims, why do you think that is? Why do we not care? Why do we like to victim blame and say, I would never do that?
You know,
when we don't know what they've been through.
It's so fascinating, isn't it? Like, it really is. Here we are, like, critiquing these people that we consider to be sociopathic and their behaviors. And we're, part of that is the lack of empathy for other people. And here we are demonstrating a lack of empathy towards the people that they victimized. I think it's just a really fascinating thing that happens. I think it goes back to what I was just saying about it's scary to think that people are out there committing crimes against other people. They lack empathy. We don't ever want to think that can happen to us, right? Like, we don't ever want to think we could be the victim of that type of crime. And so when we can categorize things in our brain that separate us from these victims, oh, I would never do that. Oh my gosh, how did they not see that red flag? That is kind of our mind's way of saying, well, I would never be in danger because I know better. I would do better. I would do differently. But we have to remember that whenever you're watching a documentary or a true crime show or things like that, these shows have been created with producers, with an entire staff of people who are painting a full picture from beginning to end, right? Like, they know when they're filming this, how the story started, where they're going, where the, how it wraps up at the end. When you are
actually, and also it's expedited too. Right. They're telling the whole story in maybe an hour, maybe 6 hours, right. 7 hours, right. If it's a documentary, like it's quick.
Right.
Whereas the victims in this have been love bombed in Simon Lviv's case. He's truly made them think that he is their person that they're going to spend the rest of their life with.
Right.
And they're reciprocating those actions because that they do have unconditional love for this person. And they think that he is reciprocating those feelings. So I think it's a lot different when we're viewing it in that little tidbit of the show lasts for 5 minutes at most. But in the story, it lasts for weeks or months or sometimes years.
Right. And when you're watching the show, it's very easy to see, like, okay, the show is called Tinder? Yeah, Tinder Swindler. Oh my gosh, I don't know why that's so hard for me to say. But it's called the Tinder Swindler. You know this guy is the evil guy, right? That's what you go in with. But imagine if just all of a sudden your coworker was starting to do weird things. Would you go around and immediately assume and start telling people you thought your coworker was a sociopath? Probably not. I mean, maybe my joke about that, but I don't think at your core, that would be your first assumption if weird behavior started happening, right? Like, like maybe you would get there eventually if they were and demonstrating those behaviors. But when it's people in our real life world, it is harder to throw those accusations or to see that picture of, especially when you yourself have empathy, when you are a good person, when you have a good heart, when you want to see the good in other people, you know, you don't want to write them off completely because of one thing that was weird or bad. And I think, you know, obviously, hopefully all of the women that were conned by the Tinder swindler, I hope that they've all gotten therapy because that is an incredibly traumatic experience and they definitely need to process and work through that and identify, you know, how moving forward, they can really respond in a different way to red flags in these types of things. But I think it's a lot easier said in, you know, watching it from an outsider's perspective. I think if we're all honest with ourselves, we have all ignored red flags at one point in time. Most of us are just lucky enough to not have ignored red flags from a sociopath. You know, like most of us are just lucky in the sense that we haven't been victimized by a sociopath, but not necessarily because we're smarter or we would make different decisions, just because that type of person hasn't entered our world.
Totally. And when Max, my partner, and I were watching the Tinder Swindler, we kept saying, at what point would we have said no?
Right.
Because I truly don't think I could have gone as far as Cicely did.
Sure.
In it, but...
And maybe you wouldn't have, maybe you wouldn't have.
I wouldn't have, but would I give my boyfriend that I loved a credit card if he's in a bad situation? Yeah, I probably would. I mean, I would do that for Max if he asked.
Yeah.
Would I take out and falsify loan documents? No, but I would still be in a lot of trouble financially just because that's something that I would do for my partner in a similar situation. And yes, you're right. Fortunately for me, I have not ever dated a sociopath, but is that because I'm smart or is that because statistically I'm not that likely to end up with a sociopath because there aren't that many sociopaths compared to non-sociopaths in the world?
Right. Yeah. You know, I think it's just these situations that, again, we want to oversimplify because they're scary and we want to think, we want to believe this could never happen to me. And the only way for this to never be able to happen to me is if they should have known better, right? If there was something they should have done differently, if it's their fault. If it's their fault, then I just need to not do what they messed up doing and then I'll be safe. But that's not the way that these crimes work. That's not the way that any crimes work.
Well, it's all an interesting conversation, but let's move on to the last topic that we're going to cover in this week's episode, which may include some sociopaths. I'm not sure, but
let's touch on what a turn.
Love is blind.
What a transition.
You know, I'm just a smooth talker like that.
So
if you missed last week's episode, we did a deep dive into Love is Blind, another great show also on Netflix if you haven't caught it. We're talking all about season two. The second half of the series was released this week with the exception of the finale.
Yes.
And some of my opinions of people definitely changed a little bit this week. So I'm interested to hear about you. Should we just go down the line and just quickly touch on all the couples?
Yes.
Some of them will dive in. Into yes. more so. Okay. Danielle and Nick. Danielle is the one who lost a lot of weight, has a lot of self-love, self-image issues. And last week we spoke about her kind of self-sabotaging the relationship. Has your opinion on that changed at all?
Yes. I think that it has gotten worse than it was before. This is by far the most unhealthy, most toxic relationship on the show. Her behavior is incredibly abusive towards Nick, and I really hope Nick says no. What I think might happen is he might say no, and then they go on again, off again, on again, off again, and that's what we learn, because this is a very dysfunctional dynamic, and until probably both of them get some very good therapy individually, I don't know that Danielle especially is in a place where she can have a healthy relationship. Just her like gaslighting Nick, her aggressive behavior towards Nick, it's extremely concerning to watch. And it is just so triggering for me every time I see her pick these fights and every time I see him excuse her behavior and apologize for things that he did not do, but he's being gaslit to believe that he should be apologizing for. It's just like, oh my God. What do you think?
I think the same. And it's really interesting with Danielle, especially because it does show a fair bit of her mom. Mm-hmm. And talking about generational trauma,
yeah,
her mom seemingly has very similar patterns.
Yes.
Talks about how she was a psychology major in college. So she really understands these things.
Yes.
But doesn't understand that she needs a lot of therapy, both her and Danielle, to work through the issues that they have. She's aware that they're there,
right,
but that doesn't make it any better.
Right, right.
And she's not doing the work.
Right, yeah. And I'll say this, like, okay, I'm a therapist. That's more than just an undergraduate degree in psychology. You know, it's an undergraduate degree in psychology, a graduate degree in psychology, plus years and years of postgraduate experience before I was able to get licensed. And so that being said, one of the most important parts of my profession is that I need to be in personal therapy to address my own stuff, because we all have our own stuff. You know, like, I can't be a good therapist unless I'm working on my own thing. So I'm not projecting those onto other people. And I think oftentimes when I hear people say, I've got a degree in psychology, and then project all this stuff onto the group, it's like, okay, well, you know, the most important thing about psychology is that we work on our own stuff before we can really give help to other people. So yeah, I think what you just said, you kind of nailed it with her mom. It sounds like she's aware, but she's not really willing to do the work.
And it's a bummer too with Danielle and Nick, because I truly do think that they could be and would be a good couple if they were both in a healthy place, ready for a relationship. Like, Danielle especially is the epitome of, you have to work on yourself to be really happy alone or totally. With someone else.
Totally.
And I think we're seeing that play out on screen.
So that's interesting that you said that, though, because I don't think that they're compatible at all. I think that's the most fascinating thing, is they're in very different stages of life. He is in a much more stable, he wants to come home and relax at the end of the day. She is very much in a party stage. She was picking a fight with him about her friend should be allowed to dance on their furniture and it might break. I don't think that they are compatible at all.
I did forget about that little segment. You're right. I take back what I said. Don't think they're compatible. I think that they both, well, we know she says yes, because that's where the last episode ended.
And he's sweating.
I hope that he says
aggressively.
No. And
he's sweating.
It is a hot day, but I don't think that's why pounds of sweat are coming out of his pores.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, okay. Next couple, Deep D and Shay. These are the two Indian born people that have never dated Indians before, and they are coming together. Last week we talked about them being a really great couple, except for the fact that Shake is kind of a dick and says that he's not attracted to Deep D, who's this beautiful woman, but he says that she reminds him of his aunt. What are your thoughts after this week?
So I really, really hope they work it out. I think I feel that he is very emotionally immature. I really appreciated the conversation he had with, I think it was Shane, actually.
It was Shane.
Yeah, because Shane was saying, in a different way than I would have probably communicated, but essentially he was communicating him, you know, you've got to get out of your head. This is an arbitrary mind block that you've created, and you have a really good thing that you're trying to self-sabotage right now, and you have to get out of your own head and just allow yourself to be happy and to be in this and 100%. And, you know, I thought that was spot on, and I really hope that he's able to do that. I think Deeps was 100% correct in that she deserves to be with someone that wants to be with her. I was so happy when Shake's mom said, you know, I'm kind of on Deep D's side with this. She deserves to be with someone who thinks, like, treats her like a princess, essentially, and thinks she's the best thing in the world. And
yeah, we all do.
Exactly. That's why I'm happy the people around him are echoing healthy sentiments, you know? That's not always mm-hmm. the case. Like, sometimes people, you know, they themselves aren't in a emotionally or psychologically healthy place, and so they can't give healthy advice. But it sounds like he's really getting good feedback and advice. And so it'll just be interesting to see if he can get out of his own head. And if so, I think that they can be really happy together. And I think that this is actually a great couple.
I agree. Moving on to the next couple, which is no longer a couple. Shayna and Kyle broke up. They ended their engagement. Oh, and hallelujah, hallelujah. That was a terrible relationship. Do we even need to talk about it, or can we move on?
I mean, the visit with her family was a little jarring to me. Like, gave me goosebumps just watching that
scene. I think it was very apparent to her family that she was not in this relationship at all. This would never work out.
Right.
They have nothing in common. She's not madly in love with him. She's not even madly in like with him. And right. Yeah, her family called her bluff, and she pretty much ended the engagement right after that visit.
Yeah. Moving on.
Ayana and Jarrett. I spoke last week about how I thought Jarrett was a better fit with Mallory, and I take that back. I think Ayana, first of all, is so cute.
She
I love
cute.
Her personality. So she's gorgeous. Yeah. Like, I just want to hug her and hang out with her because she is just like so cute and bubbly. And this week I was able to see why Jarrett chose her. I think they do have a really cute, honest connection.
That's interesting. So
there was something, I believe, that happened this week that I can't remember that I meant to write down, though.
Yeah.
I think with them, but...
So he goes out partying a lot and partying until like 3 a.m. with his friends. And she's very much a homebody. Like, when he went out partying, she was like, I'm going to stay home and read a book tonight, kind of homebody.
That was what I was referring to. That and the video games. That's what I forgot.
Oh, right. Yeah. And he's very into his video games.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know about this couple. I'm not really like rooting for them. I'm rooting for Ayana. I think she's lovely and such a sweet person, and she's had to overcome so much trauma and adversity in her life, and I'm really rooting for her, but I don't know that they are the most compatible, and I wouldn't hate it if she said no.
I could really go either way on this one. I would be sad for Ayana if they both said yes and then Jarrett doesn't put in work into making her feel loved and wanted and
appreciated. It's a bad sign, given that they only have 3 weeks between the time they got back from Mexico and the weddings are happening, and he chose to go out partying multiple nights a week during that time, even when she expressed that she was not comfortable with that. And basically his sentiment was like, oh yeah, I know I'm going to have to change some stuff when I get married. That doesn't really like bode well for me.
To be determined on that. I've not seen anything that's like, oh my gosh, this could be totally tragic. I think if Jarrett puts in a little bit more effort to, yeah, exactly, make Ayana feel wanted, all those things, I think it could be a good relationship. But if they both walk away, not the worst thing in the world. Moving on, Mallory and Salvador.
Do you want to give the backstory on them really fast before I give my opinion?
So last week we spoke about how Jarrett and Mallory were potentially a good couple. This week I saw why Mallory and Salvador really matched. I thought that they were really cute and sweet together. I think Mallory really, really loves Sal. But oh my gosh, my memory is so bad. There was something bad that happened that I know that you're going to speak on. So I'm just going to hold off on the rest of my opinion until you remind me what that is.
Okay. So as you guys remember last week, well, if you don't, I'll fill you in. Last week, I was so team Sal. He was my favorite person on the show last week. I was like, this guy is such a great guy. He's calming energy. His energy just reminds me so much of my husband. I love him. I think he's a great guy, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's changed. Now I'm not a fan of Sal, and I feel personally triggered because he did remind me of my my husband in the first 5 episodes. And I did project all of these really positive qualities that my husband has onto him. And I just feel like I was misled by Sal, because we came to find out that Sal was dating someone up until he left to film this show. And it's super sketchy. Basically, what I took it as, based on what they showed us on the show, was Sal was dating someone up until he left for the show. And one of two things likely happened. One, he just ghosted this woman and like left for the show and didn't say anything. And this woman was like, what the heck just happened? Or two, he told her, I'm going to go film this show, which I'm assuming he wanted to be on because he's a musician, just like people go on The Bachelor. And he wanted to get like Instagram followers for his music career. This is what my guess is. And he came back engaged and just pretended like he was never dating someone and didn't reach out to her. And this girl like spiraled and showed up at his sister's home and was freaking out, trying to figure out what was going on. And I guess learned he was engaged or whatever, because his story doesn't make any sense. His story is he was casually kind of seeing someone not in a relationship before he left for the show. But then, you know, it just kind of fizzled out. And then he's not really sure.
Well, he told her he wanted to find his wife. What I got from it was he was dating someone that he wasn't that serious about and got a chance to go on the show. And side note, I have a mutual friend, it's a friend of a friend who I've met a few times, who may be on season 4.
Where is season 3 happening?
I don't know.
So not the next season, but the one after that?
Yeah. So they're filming season 4 right now, like literally right now. And it happened really, really quick. Like
in what city?
From the time that Seattle.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, that's all I can say. There's like NDAs involved. And that's the other thing is once it happens pretty quick, it ramps up and then it reaches a certain point where they have to sign an NDA and they can't tell anyone whether they're on the show or not or what they're doing. They can tell people as they're ramping up and maybe on the show, but then it reaches this point where they say, I can't tell you anything or deny anything from this point forward.
I mean, did I just make this up? But I'm pretty sure someone said at some point, or maybe I saw this online, I don't know, that the casting process for all these people was like a year, but they basically told them, don't put your life on hold because we can't promise you that we're going to cast you. So I just...
Well, all I know is my friend who said that their friend was nominated by someone else and they got a call not that long ago, like no more than 2 months ago, I think.
Okay.
And they were nominated, so they did not apply themselves for the show. Okay. And then they've just been going through more and more interviews, hours of interviews, and then it reaches this point where they're top 30.
Okay, but like if I was dating someone and they were going through the application process to be on a dating show, I feel like that's important information to share with the person that you're dating. If you are not like, if you are continuing
I'm
to
not
go through the process.
I'm not excusing it, really. I think what happened is he was casually dating this girl and said, hey, you're not it. I want to find my wife. I'm going on the show. I'm not excusing his behavior. I just think that's the reality of what happened.
Why do you think that girl showed up at his sister's home then looking for him?
I think that she thought it was serious, and I think he maybe told her it was serious but wasn't actually that invested, because if you really love someone and want to see a future with them, you probably don't go on a show where the outcome ideally is that you end up married. So
I mean, I agree. I think that that is a reflection of who he is though as a person, right? Like he admitted
100%.
He admitted that he took that girl he was dating casually to hang out with his sisters on at least one occasion, but I think he said a few times. And so when you're dating someone casually, you don't really introduce them to your family and have them spend a ton of time with your family. You know, like that's
I don't think you can necessarily say that if you're friends with them. I'm not excusing his behavior. I'm just saying I could see how this could happen. A lot of people are friends with their siblings where they hang out. So yeah, if you're casually dating someone and you're getting together with your friends, it's not that weird to think that you would bring someone along. But regardless, end of story, Sal fucked up. should Mallory, is that her name?
Yeah.
Mallory marry him? I don't know. I really like how she was like, I'm going to forgive this one incident. If anything else comes up, if there is a singular red flag that is raised, I'm out. I really appreciated that, where she was just drawing her boundary real quickly. Do you think they should say yes though?
No, I don't. I don't trust Sal at all at this point. I think he's incredibly untrustworthy. I don't believe the story he gave her. And I think when she said that, his face looked like, oh shit, hopefully she doesn't find out anything else. Like, it didn't really seem very comforting.
Yeah. If I was Mallory, I would never suggest this in a normal relationship. But if I was Mallory, I would honestly be like, I need to meet with this girl and figure out what the story is. Because again, I'm a huge proponent of you need to trust your partner, yada, yada, yada. When you're making a decision on a marriage after knowing someone for such a short period of time and something like that comes up, I feel like you need to do all the research you can and really figure out what the true story is there.
Yeah. I
would not be able to forgive and forget as quickly as Mallory did.
Agreed. Yeah. I think Mallory should say no to Sal. I don't trust him and I don't think she should either.
But we'll see, because she cries when he sings Sweet Nothings in her ear and she's in deep for sure.
She is. Yeah. So that brings us to the final couple, right?
The final couple, which last week we ended the episode saying that this was the most toxic person on the show, and yes, that is Shane.
That is.
And he is engaged to Natalie. Over the past week, I started liking them. I thought, yeah, not terrible.
Same.
Shane's really stepping up. I really thought that Shane and Shayna, when they met, would do something inappropriate.
Same.
And I feel like Shane really likes, loves, cares for Natalie. He met her parents. He's been the stand-up guy. He gave Shake that great advice. And I was like, maybe I'm wrong. And then the bachelor party happened. All of the guys went to Wrigley Field together with their friends. They all got to hit some balls at Wrigley Field, and everyone hit a lot of balls except for Shane, who apparently played baseball in college, if I'm not mistaken.
I couldn't tell if they were serious or joking about that, but yeah, maybe.
Me neither, but regardless, he feels like he's a lot more sporty than, let's say, Salvador.
Oh, he was
who basically
so
hit
bad.
A home run ball, who had never played baseball in his life, and Sal just literally like almost hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And Shane genuinely did not hit a single ball. And rather than laughing it off, whatever, saying, hey, it's not my day,
right,
he got so angry.
Furious.
So upset.
Furious.
Really, like, had a tantrum.
Right.
Like, in a way that I've not seen an adult have, maybe ever.
Yeah.
And that were big red flags. And then when we see what happens next week on the finale episode, we see Natalie in tears on her wedding day, where she has been so certain this entire time that they are just perfect together. And she says that her and Shane got into an argument or something of the sort.
He said mean things to her, I think is what she said.
So I'm back on my original opinion that Shane is the most toxic person on the show, and this relationship should absolutely end on their wedding day.
So I definitely think he is incredibly emotionally immature. I think he has a lot of growing up to do. And he also is probably someone who would benefit from a lot of therapy, as we all would. But yeah, I think you hit the spot on the head. It really came out when he was embarrassed, right? And instead of being able to handle his embarrassment in a healthy and appropriate way, he became incredibly angry. And my guess is he calls Natalie when he's feeling angry and embarrassed. And instead of talking with her about feeling those things, he just takes out his anger and embarrassment directly onto her and says probably things he doesn't even mean, but she's on the receiving end of that. And that's how I'm guessing we're going to find them on this next episode. I could be wrong, but that's those are the conclusions I'm jumping to at this time. But, you know, I don't know. I don't think that they should get married at this point. I wouldn't hate it if they stayed together and he really started getting some individual therapy. They probably went to couples therapy together. I think if he worked on some of his stuff, I think that he is a good person at his core, but he really, really needs to get a handle on his emotions and being able to deal with them in a healthy way. I imagine it has to be incredibly hard to go on the show a few months after your parent passed away. I just think that that's a whole other.
Oh, yeah. I think his dad passed away like a month prior
really
to
shortly.
All of this going down really, really recently. Yeah. So I'm sure a lot of the emotions that we're seeing, I mean, after our mom passed away, I was the worst human I've ever been in my life for like a while after that, because I really did not know how to deal with my emotions.
Yeah.
So you're right. I totally forgot that that is a factor playing into this. And I'm not saying it's an excuse, but I can see how that could be playing into it, because I too have been through something similar. Another issue that I have though with the longevity of Shane and Natalie's relationship is when they were talking about finances, Natalie says, hey, I think our first place, we should just buy it. Mm-hmm. I've been saving up for a long time. I'm really financially secure. Mm-hmm. And Shane's like, no, I don't want to be that kind of couple that just like gets married and buys a house. I don't believe in 401ks.
I forgot about that, that you said that.
I don't think he has any savings based on that conversation.
I mean, I agree with you. I don't think that there's any savings there at all.
And I'm not saying you have to perfectly align, but when you are truly on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to finances, mm-hmm. that is one of the biggest triggers of issues in relationships, of divorces. And I don't think that's going to work for Natalie long term. Again, I think the reason that she's so attracted to Shane is because he is the opposite of her.
Yeah.
But I think after time, that's going to get old for her.
So I think it really depends. And I actually had a positive perspective on her perspective, I guess, on the situation. I thought it was really interesting. She's not a dumb person. And I know you and I talked about this last week. Like, we both feel like we could be friends with Natalie. She's so smart and she seems so cool and just intelligent and funny and all of these things. I think she gets it. She gets who Shane is. And she, you know, apparently is very financially successful in her career, and good for her. Like, that is freaking awesome. And I think she basically said, you know, my mom was the breadwinner in our family and I'm good with that. Like, I'm fine. I do not need a second income. Like, I can support us and that works for me. I think that that is fine. And we as a society, like, think that that is totally normal and fine if the like gender roles are reversed, right? Like, if a guy is a high earner and the girl doesn't work, or maybe works part time or works in a lower paying job, like, we don't really question it. But I get what you're saying also with, it's going to get complicated when they have, even if they keep their finances separate, like, as a married couple, as a committed couple, you can't, I mean, there's only so separate as you can keep them, right? Like, you have to file your taxes together. Like, there, it gets blended. And I think it is going to be a big problem if she is working out of budget, if she's trying to save and be responsible for their future, and he's spending $2,000 to $3,000 a month on DoorDash. Like, that's probably not going to be like a great situation long term.
Yeah, I think this is not a case of one of them's a breadwinner and one of them staying at home to raise the children. I'm not viewing it like that at all.
Right.
I'm viewing it as they are just, they have different goals.
Right.
And it's going to take a fuck ton of compromise on both of their parts to get to a middle ground from a financial standpoint.
Right.
So I don't know.
TBD. Kelly's skeptical. Kelly's a little nervous.
I'm very nervous. And with that, thank you guys so much for listening. Please remember to leave us a review, leave us a rating, tell a friend.
And don't forget, follow us on Instagram at We Thought You Asked, or on Twitter at WT.
WTYA. We Thought You Asked.
Oh, yeah. WTYA podcast. Yeah.
It's really not that hard. I don't know why you're having so much trouble with a username that you created. But anyway.
Anyways.
Thank you. And we'll see you back here next week.
See you guys next week. Bye.